Good morning. May it please the court. I'm John Gervais and I represent Donald Taylor. My bar registration number is 41168. Your Honors, this morning I plan on addressing the cell phone search issue, but if this court has questions on the other issues, I'll try and address those. I think it's important in this case to keep in mind what we're talking about in this search. We're talking about searching cell phone call information. And we're not talking about searching a closed container or a cigarette pack. And this call information in Colorado receives specific and heightened protection under our Constitution. Now, as our Supreme Court has noted in Sporleader and in CORE, call information is extremely important and can provide the state with what I think they termed a virtual mosaic of the suspect's life. Now, Your Honors, at the suppression hearing, the prosecution came and only argued plain view justified the search below. The trial court agreed, and when pressed by defense counsel, sua sponte found exigent circumstances. And now, for the first time on appeal, the state argues that the cell phone search at issue is justified by a search incident to arrest. Now, certainly it's my position, Your Honors, that this court should not address that issue as it's not properly before the court, and under Siri, the state actually forfeited the issue. Moreover, by declining to bring that to the court's attention below, it deprived the trial court of an opportunity to make findings of fact and conclusions.
Mr. Gervais, if the police officers had found a container other than a telephone in the pocket of the defendant, they certainly would be free to open that container, correct?
Certainly, yes, under Robinson, I believe that is what they are free to do.
And aren't the cases, and there seem to be quite a few throughout the federal system in any case, that analogize a cell phone to a container?
Your Honor, that is correct. There are a number of cases that do make that analogy. And certainly the court's aware, I cite to several cases that do not make that analogy. But Your Honors, the cases that make that analogy, I think, uncritically apply the Robinson rationale to cell phones. And I know the genesis of that rule, it's a Fifth Circuit case, it's either Finley or Curtis, and I'm sorry, Your Honors, I can't remember which one it is. The defendant in that case actually conceded that the cell phone should be likened to a physical container, and that's certainly not my position here. A cell phone is not like a physical container, Your Honors. Certainly, a cell phone contains things in sort of a loose sense of the word, but what it contains, what it conceals, is not physical. It doesn't conceal physical objects that can be used to thwart an arrest or harm an officer. It contains data. And data, categorically, Your Honors, cannot be used to harm an officer or thwart an arrest.
What about a spiral notebook? Doesn't that contain data in the sense of information instead of a physical object?
Well, Your Honor, I think a spiral notebook could technically contain a physical object. I mean, as far as I'm aware, it could contain a knife or something like that. I'm not convinced that it, per se, cannot contain something to harm an officer. But, Your Honor, it also contains evidence, certainly. It contains data, but that is the only copy of that evidence, and that can be destroyed. At issue here, we're talking about call data that is kept off-site by the cell phone provider. It's duplicated. So we don't have the same situation where, with a physical object, we're worried about destruction of evidence, because here, I think it's impossible for the suspect or defendant to destroy or conceal or even alter that evidence.
Is the destruction of evidence articulated in Robinson as a reason for adopting the search incident to arrest, a fairly broad articulation of it?
Well, Robinson picked up from Connell and observed that we have the two rationales, you know, officer safety and destruction of evidence. Now, Robinson in that case noted that we allow these searches per se of physical containers because we do not want officers in the field to have to make these unreasonable ad hoc judgments, weighing on the one hand the exigency and on the other the privacy interests at stake. And Robinson did discuss these rationales, but in that case it said, as with physical containers, we do not worry about whether or not those rationales apply in that specific case because we don't want officers to have to make that determination in the field. And the reason why I don't think Robinson applies here is because I don't think officers have to make an unreasonable determination with cell phones. As a categorical rule, they do not, one, have the potential to harm the officer. At least the data does not. And two, at least with call log data and emails and things like that, we don't have that risk of destruction of evidence. And so when we don't have these justifications at all, Robinson does not apply.
Mr. Gravilli, as I understand it, it's not just to look for some danger to the officer. You can actually look for evidence of a crime. And in this case, there is some nexus between why the defendant's phone was opened and the call log was accessed, because he said, hey, I'll call somebody who can deliver to you. So this really isn't the situation, is it, where you're concerned about going off the reservation, looking for something that has nothing to do with the reason the person is detained?
Oh, in this case, that would be correct, Your Honor. If you had some sort of Gantt-type analysis, I mean, certainly I'm not suggesting that the police were going on a fishing expedition just for fun. But, Your Honors, the justification allowing for a search for evidence is still, I mean, the reason why we have that justification from Robinson and Kimmel is it's still the underlying reason is the exigency, the concern of destruction of evidence or loss of evidence. And that's one reason why I cited Knowles, Your Honor. I mean, we see that the search incident to arrest exception still does depend for its justification on necessity. Even if with physical containers, the reason why we allow the per se rule is because, again, we just can't have officers making these field determinations. But cell phones, as I keep suggesting, are categorically different.
So some courts have looked at the capacity of cell phones, modern technology, to hold vast amounts of information and suggest that maybe it should be entitled to some heightened privacy protection. But it sounds to me like your argument is going more toward the ability to destroy or maintain as opposed to the capacity of the object. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I do actually argue along the lines that you suggest, and I think that's relevant from another standpoint, and that is that a cell phone's contents aren't really associated with the arrestee or within their immediate control, because partly due to the vast amounts of information that they're capable of holding. And certainly that does justify a greater protection, because the person would have a greater expectation of privacy. But it's also relevant in the sense that when we're dealing with physical containers on an arrestee's person, they're obviously very limited in size and scope, whereas cell phones are computers.
Well, just because a cell phone has a capacity to hold vast amounts of personal information doesn't mean that a person necessarily has to put their personal information in that container, right?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, they don't have to.
They can leave their information at home.
But, Your Honor, I will point out that cell phones all contain the call log information, and that information is important and does enjoy privacy expectations in this state, certainly.
A drug dealer's going to do a drug deal. Why don't they just leave their cell phone and their call log at home? They don't have to do a drug deal with a cell phone.
Well, perhaps not, Your Honors, but that doesn't entail that they don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their cell phone, generally.
Mr. Gravilli, isn't the certainly one answer here for the defendant is to use a PIN code lockout on your phone? I mean, would you anticipate that if you had that mechanism in place on the phone, and that most of them, I assume, have that feature, you'd have to get a warrant to open it?
Presumably, Your Honor, you would. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I know that that has come up recently, and I think even in this jurisdiction in the Federal Circuit. But I believe, I mean, unless the police have means of cracking that on their own, I think that would require a warrant, and I think it does regardless, but off the top of my head, I don't really have a good answer for you on that. But Your Honors, and as I've suggested, when we're dealing with call phone information, as I said, we're not dealing with objects within the arrestee's control and associated with their person. And I think that's something that this court should consider. And I believe the Schlossberg case that I cite talks about that. Certainly, also, as I've stressed, Your Honors, our Constitution protects this information to a greater degree than the federal Constitution, and Your Honors should take that into account. And what I'm stressing, essentially, Your Honors, is that the authority to search a physical container, like a cigarette package, does not extend to a cell phone. The two are fundamentally different. Your Honors, finally, I don't have a lot to say on plain view or exigent circumstances in this case, but I do want to point out that the state, at least in passing, seems to concede that it didn't meet its burden below. In a footnote, it asked this court to remand for further factual development. Certainly, I maintain that that's not appropriate, that those two justifications, they didn't meet their burden on those two, and that therefore reversal is appropriate. Your Honors, if I may, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Okay, you have 4 minutes and 13 seconds, Mr. Revelius.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Catherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. The defendant cites essentially two cases in support of his claim that cell phones should be essentially exempt from the search incident to arrest exception. And I'd like to talk briefly about the underpinnings for those two cases and why those underpinnings have been essentially rejected by other courts and why they should be rejected by this court. There's two primary reasons why the exemption, these cases, I think it's the Smith case and the Schlossberg case, talk about why cell phones should be treated differently. First is, they say other courts have treated them, analogized cell phones to a container, but in the opinion of the Smith and the Schlossberg courts, they're not considered to be a container for two reasons. One is they contain a vast amount of information, personal information, and the second being is that under Belton, the container was described as an object capable of containing another object. This premise for why we should treat cell phones differently because they're not containers is not supported by the U.S. Supreme Court case law. The U.S. Supreme Court has never conditioned the right to search incident to arrest on the nature of the item. And if you look at some of the cases I cited from the Florida Supreme Court, several of the cases, they recognize that we've never had a distinction between the nature of the item, the type of information it might contain, things like that. And unless the Supreme Court deems it appropriate to create such a limitation, we should not distinguish the right to search incident to arrest on the nature of the item.
Ms. Hansen, assume for just a moment that the defendant here not only had a cell phone, but he also was carrying his iPad. Mm-hmm. Could the officer open the iPad and look through it?
I believe so. I believe it's a personal item on the defendant or within his immediate control, assuming it satisfies that. It's a container that essentially, it's a container in a sense that it contains information, just like I believe the Diaz court talked about the similarities with the diary. A diary contains information. It doesn't contain objects. It contains information. But I think it's important to look back and say, too, the requirement of a container is actually not really a requirement. It existed in Belton. There was a container. They described the container. They said, in the context of automobile searches, you can search containers and then describe the containers. But nowhere in the U.S. Supreme Court precedent does it require that the item being seized and searched be a container. It talks about effects. Cases talk about effects, property, belongings, but there really is no container requirement. And so, as the Florida Court of Appeals, in one of the cases I cited, which has a really good analysis and review of the cases from Finley on that talk about apply the search and arrest to a cell phone, it talks about how whether it's a container or not is essentially irrelevant, because the Supreme Court case law simply does not require it to be a container.
Sanson, in the past Supreme Court cases, have they, in fact, though, whether they talk about a container or some other kind of personal effect, haven't the cases always been talking about items that conceivably could be destroyed? Do you have an example of a case where the item, like this case, has an electronic backup somewhere in the cloud so that the information isn't going to be destroyed?
Well, first of all, we don't know that. We don't know that this is information that can't be destroyed. And I invite this court, and I apologize because it was a case that came out after my my brief and after the reply brief, but I've become aware of it. And it has a Seventh Circuit case called Flores-Lopez. And basically, I only mention it because it has actually a really good description of all the different types of technology that is out there that allows people to remotely dump and wipe electronic devices, such as phones and iPads. I can provide the site if you'd like.
Do you have the citation?
Yes, it's 670 F3rd 803. And I apologize to counsel. I wasn't planning to talk about it in terms of supporting my case. But the bottom line is that, and I think the court did talk briefly about the concern that information could be bumped. There's all different kinds of ways we can conceivably see that information could be wiped, both remotely through apps. I know I have an iPhone, and I have an app on my phone that allows me, if I lose it, it just automatically dumps it.
Of course, in this case, there was no evidence before the trial court about whether something can be wiped or not.
I think that's necessary in the case when you're relying on exigent circumstances. But here we're talking about the general concept of whether this is the type of item that should somehow be exempted from the search incident to arrest.
And this concept was not raised in the court below. And could that be a reason why there's not enough evidence? I mean, what should we do about something that wasn't raised in the court below and that it needs more evidence to understand whether it can be destroyed or not?
Well, I don't think we need that because I don't think the Supreme Court has ever indicated that the nature of the item and the ability to be destroyed is a relevant factor. In fact, in Belton, the court, and this is one of the arguments by the defendant, the cell phone, once it's in the possession of the defendant, once it's the possession of the police officer, can't be destroyed. The evidence, whatever is obtained in there. But Belton has rejected that notion as preventing certain items from being search incident to arrest by saying essentially that would eviscerate the search incident to arrest exception.
What about Judge Graham's question about the PIN code lockout? Does it make a difference whether the container is locked or not?
Well, I think all that does is say that it's going to prevent a search incident to arrest because they can't get in it. It would be similar if there was some sort of box in the car that was locked with a padlock that the officers didn't have lock snaps. And so basically they just couldn't do it at that time. Some cases do recognize the ability though to do it back at the place of detention as long as it would have been valid immediately incident to the arrest. But I think in this case you just have, it doesn't exempt it from the search incident to arrest exception. It just makes it more difficult to do at that point.
So are you conceding that if the defendant had employed some sort of technology to keep the officer from looking at the call log, that in that case the police would have needed a warrant?
No. I think that's logistically the way they would have to go, but under the law, I don't think that they're, just because the defendant essentially exerts some form of attempt to make it harder to search this item, this incident to arrest, makes it exempt from that, makes it requires a warrant. I think logistically, unless the officers can get that information, and I believe they can get information like that by contacting the cell phone company.
Without a warrant?
Well, it depends. If they were to contact, I don't think in this situation, if they went back to the police station, called the phone company, and got that information, that possibly could intrude on the defendant's cell phone records or the defendant's personal information that's stored by the cell phone company. We're talking about the cell phone itself, and logistically, if they can't get into the item, same with any other item that's locked for however reason, they simply can't do a search incident to arrest.
So you're saying that if the police have a locked container, they can bring it back to the station and have some lock pick get into it, and you're comparing that to the situation that if the police have a cell phone, they can bring it back and have some computer person figure out the lock code. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so. Especially since the cases recognize that you can do a search incident to arrest at the place of detention as long as it's within reasonable spatial and time limitations.
Have a case that talks about the lock container specifically?
No. No, I don't. I have not found any cases, and certainly I don't think there's any cell phone cases where they've done that. But I would imagine
any kind of lock container.
Right.
Okay.
I have not seen any of those type of cases where they've had to go back and unlock it. I believe in Chadwick they may have had to unlock it, but the issues in Chadwick were different because there it was a footlocker. It was not something that was on his person or within his immediate control, and so they resolved the case on that basis. Factually, I think it happened there, but I have not found another case. But certainly have not found any cases that say that if you do have to perform some sort of mechanism or maneuvers to open a locked container, and I think it's clear the court certainly says open or close containers, you're allowed to search that. So I don't think that cell phones should be treated any differently. It may present a barrier to being able to do that, and the cell phone company may not provide that information without a warrant, but that being unable to do it is not the same as logistically, it's not the same as requiring a warrant before you do it. The last thing I'd like to mention, because I already talked about the fact that it doesn't need to be container, that we don't distinguish based on the nature of the item, and the fact that the defendant argues that we shouldn't allow cell phones because once they're in the officer's possession, their information is not capable of being destroyed. The defendant also argues, and I believe this came up in the Smith case as well, that we should somehow exempt cell phones from the search incident to arrest exception because you can get the information another way. In other words, through a warrant for the cell phone, especially in this case, since what was used was the call log, you can get that information through the cell phone records. And even if that's true, and I don't think it's clear that all information on a cell phone you can get through cell phone records, but even if it's true that you can get call numbers and times, again, in Belton, they recognize that essentially would eviscerate the search and arrest exception. For example, you can always say, well, the person had a bag in the car. Well, they can go back, bring it to the station, and get a warrant for that. But the law doesn't require that. And the same thing for the cell phone. Yes, you could go back, hold on to it, and get a warrant, but that doesn't mean that the officers aren't justified in searching it at that time. And if that's required to get a warrant for items that you could wait for, then essentially it would eviscerate the exception. So basically, I think this court should follow the vast majority of cases which do hold that a cell phone is a proper search incident to arrest. I think I'm entitled to raise this argument under Moody in Arnest, which has recognized that in this case, or in cases where the factual situation is developed sufficiently, this court can address issues for the first time on appeal. Thank you.
Ms. Hanson. Mr. Gravelius, before you begin, this Flores-Lopez case that Ms. Hanson cited to us, 670 Fed 3rd 803, do you have that citation?
I do, Your
Honor. I'm going to give you a little bit of time to send us five pages, and please address a copy to Ms. Hanson, and you can address the three of us individually to respond to that case.
Okay, and may I also address it now as well?
Well, if you're ready to address it now, please do.
Okay.
Well, you still can have 10 days to get something supplemental to us.
Okay. Your Honors, I want to start actually with the state's position that no case requires there be a physical container, and I'm not suggesting necessarily that the Supreme Court case law has required that there's a physical container, or that is sort of dispositive. My point really is that with cell phones, the search incident to arrest doctrine just does not apply. Now, the state maintains that no case has ever really conditioned that on the characteristics or the nature of the item, but I don't think the Supreme Court has ever had to, because it has, as you've pointed out, Judge Boris, always dealt with physical objects. So I really think that this is really just a situation where the Supreme Court didn't anticipate cell phones.
Let me go into that destruction of evidence in a little more detail, though, because if that's truly a rationale for why physical items such that could be destroyed are subject to the search incident to arrest rule. Realistically, aren't there plenty of defendants who can't, aren't in a position to destroy that evidence, or handcuffed, or they're removed, you know, the officers have taken the personal items away from their immediate possession in the course of the arrest. And so how does that practical effect play in the Supreme Court analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not really convinced. Well, obviously, I think that the justification is still required to some degree. That practical effect, obviously, in certain situations, when you're dealing with objects that could have been destroyed, does not actually require the presence of the defendant being able to physically destroy the object or hide it, but that doesn't mean that that principle or that rationale isn't there at all. And certainly, Your Honors, again, my contention is that this is the type of information that just as a per se rule falls away from that.
Right, so I'm trying to understand why you have the per se rule. I mean, I could see if you have a slip of paper with a buy list and the defendant could grab it out of his pocket and eat it or something, that could be destroyed. But it seems like there's other types of evidence not so easily destroyed, and the Supreme Court doesn't really articulate that rationale. So I'm trying to decide if there's just why, in a per se way, such items are either in or inside or outside the search incident to arrest rule.
Well, part of, I think, the answer would lie in the fact that we are dealing with something that is fundamentally different, in the sense that, one, we have a greater privacy expectation, and two, there's just a sufficient amount more of information, and I think part of that drives this concern. But, Your Honors, I do want to also quickly address this Flores-Lopez case in the time that I have. One thing that's interesting about that decision is the facts before concerned a cell phone search of the phone's number itself, not the call log. And what happened was officers actually, incident to arrest, searched, found that phone's number, and then either via subpoena or warrant, sought the actual call log information on that phone. And the Seventh Circuit didn't really address, I mean, it did talk about Robinson, and I think if you read it broadly or just sort of read the opinion carefully, there seems to be some amount of skepticism about that doctrine being used because they don't rely on it. Instead, the court held that the search of the phone's number itself was just reasonable, and so they allowed that search. Now, that rationale doesn't apply in this case because we know that this type of information gathered in this case requires a warrant under our Constitution. And so the Seventh Circuit was really, obviously, by its nature, a federal constitutional matter. But it is interesting, and it does talk about various technological aspects of cell phone data that make it different than physical containers. But, Your Honors, again, this call wiping information in the Seventh Circuit that they talk about, this technology to remote wipe, doesn't apply to call data. And so, Your Honors, I respectfully ask that this court reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Gavilius. Thank you again, Ms. Hansen. Your arguments were helpful to us, and the matter is now deemed submitted, subject to your five-page letter, or however you choose to, whatever form you choose to put it in. Okay.